actually solved a Rubik's Cube. You're going to regret asking that, because I'm going to ask you to solve it. Yes. These things are insanely popular. I've never been able to figure these things out. Do you know that this cube, does anyone know how old this puzzle is? Anyone want to take a guess?
82.
Close. I wasn't born yet, actually. It came out 10 years before I was born. It came out in the year 1974. And in 2009, it became the world's most popular toy at the time, with over 350 million cubes sold. Can you believe that? This little thing right there? What if I were to tell you that there are people who are 3 years old that can solve this puzzle? Could you believe that? Yeah? What if I were to tell you that they could do it blindfolded? Would you believe me?
No.
Go look it up on YouTube. It's pretty crazy to see what kind of things that you can do with this. You said you could solve this. You want to come down here and get it? Yeah. Come here. It's pretty crazy. I've never been able to do it. I always thought my dad peeled off the stickers and put them in the wrong spots, right? It's very interesting. I could not solve this for the life of me. But I know that there are people that are really smart that can. And everyone say hi.
Hi.
Okay. Now, you said you could solve this, right?
Yeah, it's called YouTube.
Yeah, it's called YouTube. That's cheating. Okay. All right. You said, could you solve it blindfolded?
No.
No? But you could solve it?
Yeah.
Okay. What if I told you to solve this puzzle, but I'm not actually going to give you the Rubik's Cube? Could you do it?
Maybe.
Maybe. Really? I'd be very impressed to see that. You know what? I'm going to give you this, and you got to promise me something. I want you to try and put it together before the message is done, but you got to listen to the message. Can you do that?
Just do it right now.
No, that'll take too long. There are a number of problems that I think I love solving, but sometimes there are problems in our lives that we can't solve. And I actually think that if I were actually to give you the Rubik's Cube and give you and say to you, okay, I want you to solve it blindfolded, but I'm not actually going to give you the cube, some of you would actually sit here and say, Dan, that's almost impossible. I need the cube to do that. And what I find really what is interesting about living in a non-Christian culture, a culture that does not follow God or does not worship God or does not have the same ethic that you and I do, is it puts us in places where we have to solve the Rubik's Cube without actually having the Rubik's Cube. There are problems that you and I have to solve without actually solving them. How do you solve a problem that you can't solve? I'm kind of finding that right now in my life that there are some situations that I'm going through right now where I am forced to solve a problem, but there is no human way to go about solving it. It's an impossible equation to fix, and yet I am forced into a place where I have to do this. I don't really know if you've heard about this. I think I might have mentioned it once or twice, but during the Christmas season, there was a bylaw passed that prevents me from helping you. And what I mean by that is if you were to come to me and say, Pastor Dan, I'm struggling with this and this and this. Can you refer me to someone who can help me with this? Can you refer me to a counselor? Can you give me a book? I, by law, am not able to do it. And if I did, I would either get fined, arrested, or they would come into the church, take the library books that I referred to you, and confiscate them. There are things going on right now, and I'm struggling. It's a problem, because how am I supposed to help you in a culture like that? It seems like a problem that I can't solve. Or there are situations, I'm sure some of you are taking the money course, and you're asking yourself, goodness gracious, I'm in so much debt. How do I live debt-free when I have all this debt? It seems like an impossible problem to solve. Or you think about the unity of the church. How do you have unity in a church family all throughout Three Hills when we have different views on different things? It's like the Rubik's Cube. It's like trying to solve a problem that you cannot solve in and of yourself. And that is actually the situation that we find ourselves, Daniel in. Is Daniel is placed into a situation, a problem not of his own making, that is humanly impossible to solve, and yet if he doesn't do it, he dies. And I think one of the things that you and I need to understand about living in a culture like Babylon, or a non-Christian culture, or a culture that doesn't think like us, is that it places us in a problems that we can't escape, that don't have a solution, and yet you and I are forced to make a decision about it, regardless of whether or not we want to be or not. There's no escape of that. So how do you do that? How do you solve problems that the world puts upon you that you can't really solve? For example, what if you were put in a situation where your work asks you to go against God? How do you solve that? Well, the answer might be, just don't go in that profession. But you know what the problem with that is that more and more and more and more professions are putting you in a situation where you're going against your faith. Think of an example, if you want to be a public school teacher and you have to teach curriculum you don't agree with, or is anti-God or anti-biblical, what do you do then? Or you want to be a lawyer. Well, the answer is then, don't be a lawyer. Or a baker or a photographer or a daycare worker or a doctor or a counselor. How do you counsel somebody in a counseling session when there are laws set up in the country that actually prevent you from doing that? What if you were a contractor and you were asked to build something that was against God? What do? Do you do it? You see what I'm saying? It puts you in an impossible situation. Or, for example, I don't know if you've heard the statistic before, but I remember if you're a parent who wants to teach their kids the value of respecting men and women, how do you do it in a culture where we don't respect our bodies well? 95% of men before the age of 18 will view explicit material on the internet before the age of 18. How are you supposed to train your kids in that? It seems like an impossible situation. And so here's what I'm saying. Living in a culture that's ethic is very different than our own confronts us with problems that we are forced to make decisions on without really having any human way of answering the problem. Our experience won't speak to it. Our common sense won't speak to it. Our culture can't speak to it. Our science can't speak to it. There's no way that we can do it. These are the situations that Daniel finds himself in. How do you solve a problem that you can't solve? This is where we find Daniel in our text. Daniel was placed into a situation where there was no human answer, humanly speaking, but he still had to solve it or else he would die. So I think Daniel's story has insight for us when we are faced with impossible problems. So what I'd like to do this morning is I would like to read you the story, explain the story with you, and I'd like to pull out a few practical things that I think would help. So if you have your Bibles, I'd love for you to turn to Daniel chapter 2, and we'll be looking at verses 1 all the way to 23. And the very first thing that we're going to hear about Daniel, maybe I should just do a recap, is Daniel has now been trained for 3 years in the school of the demonic, I would say. And he's either in his last year or his first year out. We're not really sure at this point. And this is what it says in Daniel chapter 2, verse 1. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. So this king had been having terrible nightmares, the kind that wake you up in the night with a cold sweat, where you find yourself awake and you just can't go back to sleep. How many of you have ever had a dream like that? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. The ones where, these are the kind of dreams where you have been sleeping all night and you wake up for the dream only to feel exhausted. We all know how a sleep-deprived mom can be a little bit unpredictable, but a sleep-deprived despot like Nebuchadnezzar is dangerous. And the first thing that we see is that the king is presented with a problem. I've got a dream, and it's bugging me to the very, very core of who I am. I have to find out what this means. Well, why did it bug him so much? It's only a dream, right? Well, here's what I think you and I need to understand. Is in order to appreciate the problem, you and I need to just kind of go back and kind of just jump back into their culture and know what dreams mean. In order to understand and appreciate what is going on, you and I need to stop and remember a few things. When we think of dreams in North America, you and I tend to think of them very Freudian, meaning that they are a result of our unconsciousness. But that's a very Western way of looking at it. In the ancient world, dreams had significance. Think about Joseph and Pharaoh, for example, or Peter's dream in Acts. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say that every dream that you ever have or ever will have is from God, but in the Bible, at least, it does seem that God spoke to people through dreams, and particularly Daniel on dreams. In fact, Jeremiah is interesting. Jeremiah actually will rebuke people who felt like God spoke to them in dreams and did not, but it seems like sometimes God did speak to people through dreams, okay? And in Nebuchadnezzar's culture, not the Israelite culture, but in Nebuchadnezzar's culture, the Babylonian culture, what you're seeing is that the dreams that people had, the king would have, would be seen as sort of gifts from the gods to the king in order to bless him and make sure that he was doing all right and give him guidance. So when he has a troubled dream, it's kind of interesting. Now, what degree did it trouble him? What degree did it trouble him? We can tell how it troubled him based upon the way that he approached it. Listen to what it says in verse 2 all the way to verse 5. The king commanded the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king, and the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. The Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. When the king of Babylon had mental problems, such as it disturbed him so much where he couldn't get his sleep, he didn't call for counselors or psychologists or doctors or dietitians, which he had. He called for the enchanters. These would have been the witch doctors of the day. They would have been trained in fortune-telling and palm-reading. They were mediums that read tea leaves. They were spirit guides of the day. They would speak to the dead. This is the group that the king went to for advice, and they were frauds, and there were four classes of them, and Daniel would have been trained in this. Okay? Number one, there would have been magicians or diviners, and they would be the priestly class. They would fulfill my role. They would open up the ancient scriptures of Babylon and depart the wisdom to the king. Then there were enchanters and conjurers, people that had great spiritual power to cast spells. Okay? Then there were sorcerers, people that contacted the dead, and they would contact the dead on behalf of the king to gain wise advice from the king. And then on top of that, there would be astrologers, people that would look at the stars in the sky and determine advice and wisdom and luck and prophecy from that. So these are the people that the king had around him. And it's actually, I don't know if you remember me telling you this or not, But it's actually from this group of people that the wise men in the Christmas story, a few hundred years later, are descended from. Okay? And we need to know something about them is that they are frauds and demonic. Occasionally, I'll run into someone who will read the Harry Potter novels and say, "Oh man, I wish Hogwarts was a real place." Let me tell you something. In Babylon, Hogwarts was real. There was a school that you would go to learn the demonic witchcraft stuff. And Daniel went through it all. And it was nothing short of demonic. And it's why it would take the time to remind you of what Revelation 18:2 says. And it speaks to this fact of Babylon. Babylon is a dwelling place for demons and a haunt for impure spirits. And it's not something that Christians should be taking practice in. And you know what? Because they're frauds. And the king knew that. The king had this feeling in his gut that these people were frauds. He didn't trust them. He goes on and says this. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show me the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation." So what's going on here is that the astrologers are like, okay, tell us what's in the dream, and then we will take the images of the dream, and we will kind of, we will resource it, and we'll resource the scriptures and all this kind of thing, and we'll come up with the interpretation. But he doesn't think that they're the real deal. He thinks that they're fake. So he puts a test in front of them and says, "Listen, I want to know if you're the real deal. So tell me what exactly the dream is, and then I will know whether or not you're faking it," is what goes on. Okay? And just for reference, just a fun fact, just so you know, when it says that they will be torn limb from limb in Scripture, that is, you and I read over it and say, "Oh yeah, that's sort of a reference to the fact that they will die." But it's actually a reference to the kind of death that they will get. See, in Babylonian times, if they wanted to execute someone from limb to limb, what they would do is they would take four trees and tie the tops of the trees together. And then they would take you and tie each limb to a tree. Can you guess what happens next? Then they would cut the ropes and your body would separate from limb to limb. Kind of makes you rethink whether you should be telling your kids the story before bed, eh? Verse 7, the wise men tried to change the situation. The wise men answered a king the second time and they said, "Let the king tell the servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation." The king pushed back again in verse 8 and says this. The king answered and said, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me, till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that the interpretation is true." The Chaldeans answered, "There is not a man on earth who can know the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or any enchanter or any Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one could show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with us in flesh." Unless they got that part right? No king, no one can answer. The problem had no human solution. At least they got that part right. There is no one on earth who can solve this problem for you. And the strategy of the wise men, I want you to catch this very importantly, because the strategy of the wise men is actually to change the king's demand. It's not actually to solve the king's problem, it's to change what the problem is. And the fact that there is no worldly way of answering the situation only made the king angrier, and it made him furious. And so this is what he does. Nebuchadnezzar then sentences all the wise men to death. Verse 12, because the king was angry and very furious, he commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Now, up until this point, Daniel's not even in the story. Okay? This is all happening without Daniel. Okay? So I want you to think about that, and I need you to stop and think about this for a moment. Daniel and his three friends were brought to Babylon against their will. They were enrolled in a school of the demonic against their will. They had very little control over what they ate. And so here they are trying to live for God in a land that is not their own. And to add insult to injury, Daniel would now be killed alongside the wizards and magicians, people he deeply disagree with. The worst of all scenarios is upon Daniel, and there's nothing that they could do that can make a difference. Daniel is going to share the same fate as the frauds. And I think I'm just going to stop there, and I'm going to point something out is this. That's really hard for you and us to hear, because the truth is that you and I might not agree with where our nation is going, but the truth of the matter is if you live for Jesus, it's not a guarantee that you won't suffer the same fate as everyone else. Hear that. It's not Daniel's fault that Judah didn't follow God and yet he's suffering because of it. It's not that Daniel believes in the magicians, but he's suffering the same fate of that. And that's really, really, really important for us to understand, because what that means is that you and I living for God is not necessarily automatic protection from all the suffering that we're going to face because the world around us doesn't follow God. If you raise your kids a certain way and you raise them, and it's not a guarantee that your kids won't suffer the same things as the kids that don't. At least it is in Daniel's case. Daniel didn't have that same protection, at least not yet. Daniel is placed in a problem that he can't solve. Nobody can solve. But hear this out very clearly, is that Daniel has to solve it, or else what happens to him? He dies. There's no escape from an impossible problem, at least in this case. And sometimes you and I are placed in situations like that. How do you solve a problem that has no natural answer? Well, I want you to read what happens in verse 14. I'm going to put it on the screen here. Says this. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion. I want you to highlight that. To Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill all the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. And Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he may show the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to the house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and his companions, and told them to seek the mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men. Okay. How do you solve a problem that you can't solve? Well, the answer is this. It's really simple. When this situation is impossible to solve naturally, I would encourage you to look for a supernatural one, and I would actually ask you to seek God for a supernatural alternative. Here's the king. What was the king's problem? I want you to catch this. The problem wasn't who interpreted the dream. The problem was is he wanted to know that the interpretation is genuine. And so I want you to catch how Daniel goes about doing this versus the wise men. The wise men tried to change the problem so it was possible for them to solve it. Daniel, on the other hand, goes to the king and says, tell me the problem. And he says, okay, I'm going to seek someone out who can solve the problem. In other words, Daniel is looking for an alternative answer to the problem. And he knows that he can't find one naturally, so he appeals to someone that can. When you and I are confronted with a problem that you and I cannot solve, humanly speaking, I want you to ask this. This will be worth the price of admission right here. Seek God for an alternative. Did you hear that? If the problem is impossible and you can't get out of it and there's no natural way to go about figuring out how to fix it, ask God to give you an alternative. And if you look carefully at Daniel, I want you to catch this because this is a pattern in Daniel. Daniel is setting up a pattern. It's not the first time he does this. When has he do it before? Someone shouted out. You should know this. Daniel chapter 1, what does he do? Hey, well, to recap in that story, he's presented with a problem, right? What's the problem? That he's presented with food that he's not allowed to eat. And so what does he do is he actually goes to the person that's in charge of him and asks for an alternative. And he's doing the same thing here. He's asking the king for time to go to a God, the God, and ask for an alternative. We need to learn the power of appeal. When the problem doesn't have a natural solution, we should ask God for an alternative one. Daniel's first move out of the gate isn't civil disobedience, at least not yet. It happens later in the story as he does exercise civil disobedience. But at some point, what Daniel does is he looks for an alternative. He didn't go to the king either the first time or the second time and said, I don't care what you say. I'm not going to do what he do. He didn't say, you're a vile and nasty king, and this is a corrupt and evil place. What he did was he looked at it from the guise of wisdom and prudence and asked God to give him a way to be faithful to God in the midst of it. He asked for an alternative solution. And why I think this is so important is because Daniel understands the sovereignty of God. As Daniel understands that in Daniel chapter 1 verse 2 that God placed him there, and so he goes and he asks the people for an authority for a way to go out of it. And I really believe that there are problems that you and I are facing right now in the cultural moment that we're in our families, in our businesses, in our schools, in our workplaces, where the culture around us is putting us into problems that we can't face, and we don't know how to solve them. Ask God for an alternative. That's how Daniel did it. How exactly did Daniel do that? I'm going to give you four reasons, and I think this will be the practical part, and this will help you immensely, I think. First of all, I want you to understand that Daniel did something very interesting, is that he kept his cool, and he asked questions. It says this in 14, then Daniel replied with what?
Prudence
and discretion. Okay. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? You know what, friends? I think it's so easy to lose your cool when you're about to lose your head. Is that not true? That's true. I don't hear an amen to that. Watch you catch what happens is Daniel does not panic. He kept his cool. He didn't, and that's different because our normal reaction to the situation that Daniel might be in is fight, to yell or scream, or you run and hide. Daniel, however, under fire, kept his wisdom and tact in place. He did not jump up and down. What did he do? He asked questions. When you are under fire at work or at marriage or at church, one of the best things that I could ever ask you to do or just ask questions. Why is it this way? What is going on? What is happening? That's what Daniel is doing. Why is the king's matter so urgent? There's wisdom and discretion in that. The second thing that Daniel does to find an ulterior solution is that he fostered positive relationships with ungodly leaders. This will be worth your money right here if you could do this, okay? Listen to this. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said, I have found among the exiles from Judah a wise man who God has made known to the king the interpretation of the dream. Arioch comes up a number of times. In verse 14, it says this, then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to who? Arioch. The captain of the king's guard who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to who?
Arioch.
Now who is Arioch? Well, Arioch is the professional assassin of the king. It's his job to go out and kill people on the king's order. All the king has to do, all Nebuchadnezzar has to do, is kind of give the nod. Kind of like that. And you're dead, right? And that is what this man's life was like. Your Monday to Friday might be to print stuff or to sell homes or to take care of the harvest or whatever. His Monday to Friday was to go and assassinate whoever the king wanted. What kind of guy do you think that man has to be? It's just another Tuesday to him. He walks in from home. His wife has a nice meal on the table for him. Hey, honey, how's your day? Oh, man, I just killed like 100 people for Nebuchadnezzar today. Oh, that's nice, sweetheart. Right? What kind of guy is like that? Well, he would have to be a pretty ruthless guy, a pretty cold guy, a pretty calculating guy, a guy that probably does not either fear God or worship Daniel's God. Okay? He's the kind of guy that most people would fear so much that they would either ignore or stay out of his way. But it doesn't seem like Daniel does that. It seems that most scholars seem to have suggest that there has to be some sort of positive relationship that Arioch has fostered with Daniel in the past. And the reason that I would say that is because that at this point in the story, Daniel is still an up-and-comer, okay? It's either his second year or his final year of school or it's his first year out. We're not totally sure. And so he would have been getting noticed, but he's still not on the level where he can go and just barge into the king and ask for the king's advice. He's still low on the pecking order. So the fact that Arioch was willing to have a conversation with him, this cold, ruthless murderer, and tell him what exactly is going on, suggests to scholars that there is some sort of positive relationship that Daniel is having with the king. Okay? And I want you to catch this, because this is a pattern that we see established with Daniel over and over and over again. He did this in the last chapter too. When he was presented with the food problem, he made a relationship with who? The eunuch. And he asked for permission. And here's what I want you to catch that is so crucial when you and I live in an ungodly culture, is that Daniel identifies those who have authority over him, and rather than ignore them or stay out of their way or even rebel against them, he befriends them. He acknowledges their authority and works within the parameters that have been given to him. Given what we know about Daniel, I think this is crazy. He believes that God is sovereign, and he believes that whoever is over him is placed there by God. And so what you notice is that when Daniel is faced with a situation where his faith and the way that he lives are opposed, he's never strident. He's never abrasive. He's never antagonistic, at least not at first. He is respectful. He was friends with a killer, a man who did not fear God or worship God, and he fostered relationships with unbelievers, so much so that it was positive and it paid off in a moment of crisis. So here's the takeaway for you and I. I think wise Christians who want to make an impact on this world need to form real and deep relationships with people that make decisions before the crisis comes. In a way where it pays off in the moment of crisis. Imagine that for a minute. When you're dealing with principals or teachers or government officials or employers or professors or whatever it is, wouldn't it be better to have a personal relationship with them before the crisis hits? I was just watching the news, the 6 o'clock news. How many people still watch the news? A few of you. Well, the other day they were running a story on the Calgary City Council. Apparently, they were making some bylaws that people didn't agree with, and these people started protesting in front of their own houses. So they passed a law unanimously that they would each give every counselor $10,000 for home security. And I thought about that for a minute, and I thought, listen, if you were a person who was negatively affected by a governing decision, who are you going... Who has the ear in that moment? Is it the protester or is it the friend? It's the friend. And this is what we see in Daniel. Daniel befriends Arioch, and I want you to catch this. It's Arioch who brings Daniel before the king. Daniel does not have the kind of clout, the kind of prestige, the kind of thing where he could just barge into the king anytime. He befriends Arioch, a godless man, and what he winds up doing is he's granted an audience with the king. He has the king's ear because of the personal relationship that he built, at least a positive one. What if you did that? What if you just looked at your children's teachers or the principals and just invited them over and tried to establish the best relationship you could with them? Do you know who's they're going to listen to when the controversial decisions are made? It's not the people with the protest signs. It's going to be their friends. Daniel's wise. Shows wisdom. Thirdly, Daniel asks for time. He goes in front of the king and he makes known to Daniel and he just asks, hey, can you give me time? And you know what's so interesting about this is there's an art of appeal. He doesn't even ask for how much time. He lets the king decide it. And I think that would be any time that you and I are faced with a decision and we need God's help with. I think it would be just a prudent measure to ask the Lord to give us time. Do you know one of the cool things I like about being a part of Manor is that when there is a decision that we disagree with, one of the first things that we do is just say, let's give ourselves time to pray so that we can seek the Lord. That is really, really good. Lastly, Daniel gets people praying. What does he do? Is he goes and he makes the matter known to his friends and they seek the Lord together. That's what he does. And then what happens as a result in that? Verse 19, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in the vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. God gave Daniel the Rubik's Cube. Did you finish it? Nice. Look at that, guys. I was half tempted to peel off the stickers and see if you could do it. Friends, we're living in a moment where I think we are going to be presented with problems that we've never faced before. situations that are really awkward and they have no human wisdom. There's no way to solve it, humanly speaking. And Daniel gives us a great model of leadership in that. A role model to follow is that he seeks a supernatural one by asking God for an alternative. So if you're ever faced with a situation in life that you can't be solved with, that can't be solved, humanly speaking, take some time, pray, and seek God for an alternative solution.